This is Programming Next podcast number 53, and today we're talking about wind turbines in urban environments. So how the urban environment affects wind turbine performance, what type of wind turbines you'd want to have in urban environments, and the considerations that you have. So this is kind of in line with the last few podcasts we've been doing. So podcast number 48, 49, 51, and 52. We look into all different wind turbines and the different development of them. This one is about the urban environment. And to do so, we're going to look at a paper called A Review of Urban Wind Energy Research, Aerodynamics and Other Challenges. It's open access, so you can find it in a link in the description. So first of all, they say that advances in building aerodynamics have provided new insight on the local flow occurring at the rotor location. And this is quite interesting. It means that unlike other wind turbines, so when you see a wind turbine out in a paddock or whatever, or on top of a mountain ridge, these have very different flow conditions to ones in urban environments. And what we'll find later in this podcast is that the buildings around really do affect the flow that the wind turbines are seeing, and potentially for the better. So the first thing is they have a picture of the boundary layer over an urban environment. And this is actually not as intuitive as what you would think. So there is a part of the boundary layer which is very similar to a boundary layer profile that you see in any wind tunnel or whatever. But at about person height, so like let's say 2 meters tall, there's this localized increase in the velocity that you get. So it doesn't go to zero at the base, at the surface, which is not like a typical boundary layer. Then after that local maximum, it then reduces in velocity and then it speeds up again and follows the typical boundary layer profile. And that means that at ground level, we actually have a higher velocity than slightly higher, like maybe one story or two story building. So that's quite interesting. Now, when they try to test the urban environment, one of the major problems is that every urban environment is different. So, you know, you have all different buildings of different sizes at different placements around, and the only really way to determine what, you have two options to determine what an optimal position of your wind turbine will be. The first is a stochastic approach. So you just use rules of thumb that have been determined from testing lots of different urban environments, and then you get averages. Or you can install actual weather stations, like to determine what the velocity of the air is at your site. So then you can figure out where to place your wind turbine. This obviously takes longer to do because then you have to, you know, run it through the seasons and different storms and that. So there are two different ways to figure out where you want to put your wind turbine and what type of wind turbine you want. So they have a part here where they say the building influence and wind energy exploitation. So they have a really nice picture here. If you don't have the paper in front of you, I suggest getting it because they have a nice picture which shows you the roll-up of the flow around a building. So like a typical cubic building, you have the wind coming in and it follows a typical boundary layer profile approximately. At the base, you get a horseshoe vortex. Then over the top, you get, actually over the top and sides, you get separation points. So like sort of laminar separation bubble kind of things before reattaching. And then behind the building, you then get also this sort of arched vortex roll up as well. And I've actually seen this a lot in our simulations that we do on YouTube. So we do like lots of fun little simulations. And behind this building, this cube, is exactly what we've found like dozens of times. So that's quite cool. And they say the main regions of interest in urban wind energy are those where the flow application occurs. So what that means is, as we've all sort of experienced, like when you're walking into an alley, often the flow, the wind in the alley is faster than when you're walking out in a field or whatever, even though the wind on that day may be the same velocity at both areas, because you have buildings, they funnel the air and it creates kind of this Venturi effect. And so they say such flow accelerations are well known to occur above the roof as well as the side facades. In practice, highly urbanized zones adjacent buildings would prevent such a possibility. So if you have lots of buildings very close together, then you can sort of stop that from happening. But sometimes that is beneficial. Like if you have a faster moving flow, you can get more velocity, you can get more energy out of your wind turbine. So it really just depends. And they have some examples here. So for example, just a regular building, the flow going over the roof will accelerate to some extent. And it depends where you put your wind turbine on the roof. So whether it's very forward, very back, or low or high, you can exploit that and get more energy out of your wind turbine, as we'll see later. Also, when you're putting your wind turbines to the sides of buildings, the flow going around the building, it accelerates a little bit as well. So then you get faster moving flow into your wind turbine. And again, when you have two buildings close next to each other, in between the two buildings, you get this Venturi effect kind of thing, where the flow has to like really funnel through, and it has to accelerate just to get through, because the area that it can go through, the cross-sectional area, is less than the area that it came from, so it has to speed up. So these are all little tricks that you can use to increase the output of the energy of your wind turbines. They say various reattachment length predictions on the roof and behind the buildings, obtained using various models, including large eddy simulation, have been investigated. Unfortunately, they say that certain authors that did investigate it did not discuss the separation bubble height above the roof. So, as I mentioned, when the air goes over a roof, it's pretty cool. It detaches at the leading edge, then it takes a certain amount of length to reattach. And I say this is very important because when considering the wind turbine, it's going to be on the roof, and you need to determine whether you want to put it higher, lower, closer to the leading edge, or further away. They say that another researcher provides details of the roof flow in terms of the separation bubble size, and separation streamlines are obtained by the authors, and they're shown in Figure 5. So let's look at that quickly. What they found was if you have a rougher roof, the distance from the leading edge that the separation bubble reattaches, it drops. So that's quite nice. And that's kind of to be expected. If you have a rough surface, it really acts like a laminar suppression bubble, where it will suppress the laminar suppression bubble. And we've done podcasts on LSBs. So if you want to learn more about that, you can check those ones out. But the separation bubble here really seems to act very similarly. So the roof separation layer is still expected to be a function of the roughness, particularly due to the roof roughness itself. So that's quite cool. Another interesting thing is they say that the flow coming over the roof can have different skew angles. So obviously, when it's just detaching from the leading edge, the flow is going to be up at an angle. So that's a positive skew angle. And then when it's coming down to reattach, that's a negative skew angle. And that is going to affect the flow physics around the wind turbine, in particular the wake. So if you have a positive skew angle, so the flow is still going up and it hits the wind turbine, the wake is also going to be moving up as well. Alternatively, if you have the yaw angle negative, so the flow is coming down at an angle to the building and it hits the wind turbine, the wake is also negative as well, so it goes down. And they say that some researchers using a CFD approach study the effect of different roof shapes, including flat, domed, gabled, pyramidal, vaulted, and wedged, on the flow acceleration. They found that the vaulted roof could provide an energy increase of 56.1% at the center of the roof. And they said that other researchers provided another extension of this finding. They found that the cylindrical wall provided an even better performance than the flat with low terminal intensities. So now they've introduced another idea, terminal intensities. And depending on the terminal intensity, the type of roof that you want may be different. But interestingly, the vaulted roof, you can get 56.1% more energy just by having that type of roof. That's pretty cool. Now they move into horizontal axis wind turbines versus vertical axis wind turbines. Now, in podcast number 51 and 52, I talk about them extensively, and I talk about what the benefits of horizontal axis wind turbines are compared to vertical axis wind turbines. So Horts instead of Vorts. The Vorts are the German equivalent. But anyway, in full scale, the Horts are far more favorable, generally speaking, but in small scale, so on urban environments, in urban environments, the Vorts are much better than the Horts, as we'll get into. First of all, the Horts, the horizontal axis wind turbines, small scale Hort research for urban wind energy used is much less documented than Vorts. Now, that's the exact opposite when you're looking at full scale, when you're looking at those massive 70 meter tall wind turbines. They say one of the main reasons why Vorts are better suited to the urban environment is due to the fact that the Vort operation is independent of the wind direction, which is a massive benefit because in an urban environment where the wind is very, it can just be whatever, it's very chaotic. Having a horizontal axis wind turbine, the wind needs to really be coming at a certain angle in terms of like the free stream direction to be able to extract energy. Whereas for vorts, you don't really need to care about that. Let's say usually small scale vorts for urban development have a wind vane in order to direct the turbine rotor perpendicular to the main flow direction. So let's discuss this. What they're saying is the typical horizontal axis wind turbine that you see in like pictures everywhere in the countryside, what they use then, they shrink them down and they put them onto buildings and whatever, and then they put this shrouding around it. So like this nozzle to really direct the flow, redirect it into the wind turbine so it's more beneficial for the wind turbine so you can produce energy instead of it being just any direction. They say vorts need to be installed outside of the flow separation zones around buildings, including the roof separation zone. The effect of the roof surface does not seem to play an important role in the wake dynamics. So that's pretty interesting. For vorts, that's not the case, as we'll find out. For vorts, the influence of skew was, for all intents and purposes, equivalent to the yaw unless the skew angle was negative, so going downwards. In such case, the influence of the roof might be more important. So that means that vorts, to some extent, are less sensitive to the flow direction as long as it's aligned in the approximate direction that it needs to produce energy. So it's kind of like if you're in this certain region, then it's really beneficial. If as soon as you're out of it, then the horses go terrible. They can't do anything. So it's very hit and miss, it seems. They said that when the turbine power coefficient, which is a measure of the efficiency, was found to increase even in the close vicinity of the roof, but above the separation zone. They say a contour of the resulting velocity magnitudes is shown in figure 7, so let's look at that. This is pretty cool. They have the building and the flow is going from right to left. I don't know why they did that. It should always be left to right because we read from left to right in English, so it's easier to comprehend in our minds. But anyway, it's from right to left. And what they find is that the flow going over the roof, obviously you get that separation point. And then there's a point where you're getting quite a high velocity of flow fairly close to the building. And then if you stick your rotor into that region, you can then increase the energy that you're getting out of the flow. They say since the wind resource is rather limited in urban environments, one of the main desirable features of the small scale turbine is the minimum startup torque required, which is determined by what is commonly known as the cut-in wind speed. And I've talked about that in the last few podcasts about wind turbines. But what they say here is, so these two researchers, actually, let me just quickly cover what this startup torque and cut-in wind speed is. So what this means is, if you want to know more, check out those podcasts. But just in a nutshell, if you have a wind turbine, to get the blades moving, you need to have a certain amount of wind, a certain velocity. If you don't have that, then the blades will just stay still. So that's the cut-in wind speed or the cut-in torque or the startup torque. So they say these two researchers, Wright and Wood, have performed field studies on small-scale vorts and showed that most of the starting torque is contributed by the root of the blade. That's interesting. However, most of the power generated is then contributed by the outboard region of the blade. So that's interesting. It means that the root of the wind turbine is really contributing the most torque to actually getting it started. And then once it starts, the rest of the blade kicks in and produces the energy that you want. Now, for large-scale wind energy studies, which is when they're out in the field, you know, the certain wind tunnel studies have been performed on small-scale rotors, but there's always been a discrepancy in terms of Reynolds numbers. And again, I talk about that in the other podcasts. One of the main problems is obviously when you shrink it down, you need to increase the speed, but then when you increase it too much, you then get compressibility effects. So one way to get Reynolds number similarity, like it's not technically Reynolds number similarity, but similar flow physics, is by making the blades rougher, the surface of the blades rougher. That can then trip the boundary layer into a more turbulent boundary layer, which approximates a higher Reynolds number. And again, I've talked about how terms densities and Reynolds numbers are related in other podcasts. Check them out. I'm not going to go into that here, but that's just in a nutshell. So in these large scale wind turbines, the research has been a little bit incomplete simply because it's just really difficult to get Reynolds number similarity in a wind tunnel for it. But when looking at urban environments, the wind turbines are much smaller. So that means you can put them into wind tunnels, and then you can get Reynolds number similarities, which means you don't have that problem. That's really good. It means you don't need to worry about all these little how should I call them? Little fudge factors that you have to implement to get some sort of semi-accurate result. You don't have to do that with the urban environment, so that's very nice. So before we go any further, I just want to say to make sure to check out some instruments that we do here, in particular the Atmosphere Hawk. If you're an experimental aerodynamicist or even a CFD aerodynamicist and you're using validation data from experiments, you need to make sure that those experiments, you know the density of the area that you're using in them. If you don't know the density, then you're going to get about a 2 to 4% error in your results, and that's not good. It means that your Reynolds number is going to change by about 5 to 10% on any given day, and then between seasons even more. Your lift and drag coefficients that you measure in your forces are going to be very different, up to 10% as well. That means that your results are not going to be the highest quality, and to find trends is going to be very difficult. So our Atmosphere Hawk accurately measures the temperature, barometric pressure, and humidity to give you a very accurate density. It puts it onto a large screen so you can see anywhere in your wind tunnel, and you can factor that into your calculations while you're doing your experiment, so you can get the right values straight up. You don't have to waste all this time in your wind tunnel fiddling around with stuff, then going back to your computer and doing the post-processing and finding out, oh, this data sucks, I need to go do it again. You just do it straight away, right the first time with our Atmosphere Hawk, the instrument. So check that out, link in the description. Now let's move on to vertical axis wind turbines. So I mentioned that vorts are better for large scale, vorts are better for small scale. Let's cover why vorts are. So they say vorts fall into two main categories, Darius and Savonius. In podcast number 51, I go through in detail the differences between these two, but just briefly, the former, so Darius, is usually considered a lift type of rotor. So it uses lift, it generates lift to move the blades. On the other hand, the Savonius rotor is a drag type rotor, so it uses drag to move the blades. And the flow physics is very different. The efficiencies that you can get out of them are very different again. So they have two fundamental different ways of operating. Now, moving on, they say the bound circulation of a vort blade varies along the blade as a result of the non-uniform induction field, and also varies in time due to the rotation of the blade, causing a windward and leeward motion, which changes the angle of attack periodically. Okay, this is a really dense sentence that they have. Let's break it down. The bound vortex of a on a vort blade. So let's talk about bound vortex, because this is a very unintuitive property of any lifting surface, and it's effectively mathematical in essence, but I'm going to try to explain it to you briefly what it is in an intuitive way. So intuitively, it's effectively how much this lifting surface is changing the direction of the flow. In mathematical speak, it's line integral of over the it's a bound line integral over the blade. But that doesn't mean much to you because it's not intuitive. Intuitively, it's just really how much the blade changes the flow direction. And that's related to lift. So the greater the circulation, the greater the lift that you produce. Now, it goes to a certain extent where high circulation is good. Once you get past a certain amount of circulation, then you can start increasing drag a lot because the induced drag skyrockets. So there's this balancing act. Now, with the rest of this sentence, they say the bound circulation, as I've mentioned, on a vort blade varies along the blade as a result of non-uniform induction field, and also varies in time due to the rotation of the blade, causing a windward and leeward motion, which changes the angle of attack periodically. What that means is when the blade goes around, you're producing a different amount of lift, you're producing a different amount of circulation, and that changes the effective angle of attack of the oncoming flow, because the circulation affects the flow, like it induces flow around it and changes the angle of attack slightly. It's a very complex phenomenon, and you can spend years and decades understanding it, but just generally speaking, the circulation will manipulate the flow around it, the bound circulation, which will then change the angle of attack, the flow coming in at a certain angle, and that will change the angle of attack of your blade. What's more, with these blades moving around in the vorts, because they move around a central axis, which is straight up, they have different angles of attack as they go around, and so that changes circulation as well. They say the variation of bound circulation along the blade gives rise to trailing vorticity, which is true. As I mentioned, circulation affects induced drag, and induced drag is related to the vortex that you form, the vorticity. So trailing vorticity is a direct function of the circulation that you have and how it changes more accurately. Again, this is a very complex topic, and I hope that I explained it in a nutshell to you well. If I haven't, let me know in the comments, and I'll try to do better either in the comments, or maybe I might do an entire podcast about it, I don't know. But hopefully I did it justice here. So they say, in the wake, self-interaction of this vorticity field results in complex wake kinematics. So in other words, when you get this vorticity being shed, and also this changing in vorticity and changing along the span, this all interacts, and then it creates this very complex wake. And that's true for pretty much any lifting surface. You get that really complex wake. And they have a nice figure here that some researchers have gone through stereo PIV from a vort. And you can see that there is this periodic shedding of vorticity off of the blades. And on one side, it's in a certain phase, on the other side, it's completely out of phase. So, like on one side, it sheds one vortex, then the next instant in time, it sheds the next vortex on the other side and keeps flipping and flopping back and forth. It's a very nice diagram. And really, the vorticity that comes off of the trailing edge dies out very quickly, leaving just the wingtip or the blade tip vortex, I should say. The blade tip vortex is quite similar to the wingtip vortex, it looks like. And also have the evolution of the leading edge vortex circulation of different blade azimuth positions. So let me quickly describe what this is. The blade going around really seems to just act very similar to a dynamic stall of a wing. So when you have a blade going around, the angle attack changes, and it changes with time. And this then creates this leading edge vortex that rolls up. This leading edge vortex is often very beneficial for lift production because that's a very low pressure core, which artificially boosts the lifts because you have such low pressure on top compared to on the bottom. And this just grows as you go around and breaks down. So it's effectively a dynamic stall that's occurring. And then when it comes back around, it reattaches the flow and then it goes through the same motion again. They say the authors of a certain paper claimed that below a critical Reynolds number of 30,000, the performance of a vort reduced for a smooth blade surface. Now, this is very expected because if you know about laminar separation bubbles, which I've covered in other podcasts, below about 50,000, you can't get an LSB to reattach very easily unless you make the surface very rough. That means you get a dramatic loss in lift. And that's what they're finding here. So what they're saying is, if you go below a certain level, in this case it was 30,000, that's probably lower because you have a dynamic phenomenon occurring as opposed to a static phenomenon. And they're saying below this, the vort performance reduced for the smooth blade. They said that beyond the critical Reynolds number of 30,000, the performance improved with a rough surface finish of the blade, which makes sense. So if you have, let's say, 10,000 or 20,000 Reynolds number, you want to roughen up those blade surfaces to trip the boundary layer to get rid of the laminar separation bubble that forms. And that way you can continue to produce high lift at low Reynolds numbers. And this is quite interesting because it's very akin to dragonfly wings. So dragonfly wings, they operate at about 50,000 to 70,000 Reynolds number. And in nature is amazing. Over the years of evolution, it's figured out, obviously through trial and error, that at 50,000 Reynolds number, these wings, they are susceptible to laminar separation bubbles, which means that the dragonfly will just lose lift and performance just randomly. So to overcome this problem, the dragonfly wings are actually crinkled. So imagine getting a piece of paper and just scrunching it up and then pulling it back out, and you have all those ridges left. That's what a dragonfly wing is like, and that's to get rid of to turbulate the flow over the surface to get rid of the laminar separation bubble. So that is amazing. And then what they're saying here is effectively the same thing. They probably don't know that they're doing the same thing that dragonfly wings have done, but they are, which is convergent evolution, you could say. So they say this issue of blade roughness has very important implications given the exposure of urban wind turbines to possible causes of roughness, including ice, insects, and salt deposition, amongst other factors. So what they're saying is that this fouling of the blade, so like ice, dust, and debris and dirt on it, is actually potentially beneficial because that roughens the blades up, and then you can get a high performance. That's often the exact opposite of what you want in terms of the blades, but in this case, it's very beneficial. They say the presence of skewed flow on roof-mounted wind turbines, as highlighted earlier, points to the need for dedicated aerodynamic analysis of this phenomenon. This skew is well known to be detrimental for ports, but favorable for vaults. So again, this is why vaults are better for urban environments compared to the ports, and ports are better for the large scale in out in the natural environment. They say the results of a couple of different studies were consistent in that an increase in the power coefficient of about 0.2 for the non-skewed case may be observed at a skew angle of 25 to 30 degrees. So what they're saying for vaults, if you have a skew angle of 25 to 30 degrees, you're increasing the power coefficient by about 0.2, which is massive. Like, that's in some cases that could be doubling the efficiency of a wind turbine. And some other researchers showed how the thermostensity can reduce the sensitivity of the turbine performance to the Reynolds number using wind tunnel testing. And that's obvious, as I mentioned earlier. If you increase the surface roughness, or if you increase the turbulence, that gets rid of the lattice pressure bubble, which makes it less reliant, less of a function of the Reynolds number. And also the Reynolds number, as I mentioned earlier in podcasts, it is the ratio of the inertial forces to the viscous forces. If you increase the thermostensity, that's effectively artificially increasing the Reynolds number. So they're very intimately related. So they found that, and other researchers have found that there is some improvement in performance with high thermostat levels compared to very low thermostat levels by 0.5%. So the thermostensity can increase wind turbine performance. They also said the authors claim that the startup of the wind turbine was improved as well with increasing thermostensity, which makes sense as well, because if you have a very low wind speed, you're going to get lattice pressure bubbles, as we mentioned earlier. They're detrimental to wind turbine performance. So by having higher thermostensity, you get rid of the LSBs and improve the startup with lower cut-in frequency, lower cut-in speeds. So that's wrapped up quite nicely there. So at high velocities, greater than 8 meters per second, the power coefficient was found to be smaller than that for the no turbulence case. This was attributed to by the authors to gusts which caused furling. Now, let's look at rotor design. They say some authors, Laren and others, Laren and buddies, performed an optimization analysis on position, blade number, and circumferential length of a horizontal Savonius rotor. Interestingly enough, the paper proposed a synergistic approach where the building was included within the simulation. And this is interesting. What they're saying is that when you're determining what rotor design should have, you need to factor in the building as well, because the building aerodynamics does impact the rotor. They interact with each other. So that's quite a big step forward in terms of the thinking and design process. Now, perhaps the most interesting and well-researched solution to improve the performance of urban wind turbines is a shrouded rotor concept. And this is quite interesting. I mentioned this briefly earlier. By employing a diffuser all around a hot rotor, a flow acceleration and therefore increase the mass flow rate through the rotor may be obtained. This mass flow rate increased depending on the diffuser itself. So what they're saying is if you put a shroud around the horizontal axis wind turbine, you can then funnel air through it further, quicker, which then increases the velocity of the flow that's hitting the wind turbine and increases the amount of energy you can get out of it. So even though the free stream velocity might be, let's say, 10 meters per second, inside this little localized region, it might be 15 meters per second. So that's really good. You can get a lot more energy out of it. They say by employing an airfoil section, a lift is generated all around the diffuser, which causes a circulation and hence an increased flow through the rotor. So in other words, using circulation, you can then sort of shove more energy through, so shove more flow through the shrouding, which then increases the mass flow rate. It can be theoretically shown that the increase in the power coefficient of the rotor is proportional to the ratio of the mass flow rate through the diffuser and the mass flow rate through the rotor when the diffuser is not present. In effect, this means that the Betts limit can be exceeded. So I've talked about the best limit at length in the last few podcasts. Briefly touching on here, the best limit is how much energy you can extract from the flow. And that theoretical limit is 59.3%. In reality, it's even less because you have losses. But if you artificially increase the mass flow rate through clever engineering, such as putting the shrouding that increases the flow rate, you can exceed the best limit, which is amazing. Most wind turbines operate around 40% efficiency, so 20% less than the best limit. But with the shroudings, you can beat it. You can get to like 70%. So they say the authors reported an improvement in the power coefficient from 0.135 to 0.34 by using a diffuser. So 0.34 is huge. As I mentioned, the best limit is 59.3%, so this is more than half. And they just have a brief picture of this diffuser. So it's, as you'd expect, just a cowling around the rotor, angled at a certain, like sort of fed out at the back, so the trailing edges are tilted out, and this increases the mass flow rate. So they say for vorts, so these shroudings, they're used for horts, but for vorts, the analog of this shrouded rotor would be a wind booster where the rotor is contained between an upper and lower surface. So the vort that spins around its vertical axis, you put a plate on top and a plate on the bottom, and you can then get a similar sort of effect. I'm not sure if it's as good as the shrouding for a hort, but I mentioned here that it's still going to increase the efficiency. So they say that some authors through CFD show that the action of the building was similar to that of the shrouding or a duct, and hence the power coefficient increased because of this, and the best limit was exceeded. So because the flow separates and you get skew angles over the building, that is actually potentially beneficial for wind turbines, and they act as this shroud or a duct, so you can get more power, which I mentioned earlier is not that surprising, I guess, considering that you have this air that's hitting the building and needs to go somewhere, so it has to flow around the building. It has to accelerate to do that, and that's why we get this increase in the exceeding the best limit. They say that it was also found that contrary to the isolated turbine, the turbine was not sensitive to the yawed inflow. Not only this, axial flow was not necessarily the condition that yielded maximum power. So what that means is if the flow was not directly on, if it's at an angle. The authors claim that the yaw angle for maximum power corresponded to minus 10%, so a negative yaw angle, or sorry, negative in northwesterly direction. This angle will, of course, depending on the building shape. So again, having the flow straight on is not necessarily the best. They say the authors concluded that the highest flow application occurred in diverging rather than converging configurations. This is contrary to the principle governing the Venturi effect, which is the same principle that the authors rejected in the case of building flows due to the unconfined flow above the building. So that's a good argument. And this was confirmed recently through PIV experiments. So onto noise and vibration. Certain authors concluded that the annoyance due to visual impact was correlated to annoyance caused by noise. So in other words, these people who say that wind turbines are annoying, they are traumatized by wind turbines. Anything to do with wind turbines, whether that's noise or visual, that sends them off the deep end and they get upset. So there is no direct effect of the wind turbine noise in terms of sleep or psychological stress. And this is one thing that has been a point of debate for like two decades at least. There are all these people who live around wind turbines, particularly those really big ones, and they say that, oh, wind turbines are disturbing our sleep. And then the researchers come out and then they do their tests. They find that it shouldn't be, and they go, no, it's not. And they go, okay. And then they go away, and then they come back and say, oh, it's disturbing our sleep. So they go through this entire routine again. I think they just like each other, and they have to pretend to be annoyed just to see each other more. Anyway, noise emissions from wind farms are, however, greater concern than those due to micro and small-scale wind turbines. Taylor and Buddies, on the other hand, reported a correlation between the general attitude towards wind turbines and the perception of noise emanating from these machines. Typical sound levels reported 45 dBA. So A is just the weighted version for our human hearing. So 45 dB. And that corresponds to a wind speed of 7 meters per second. Such levels are on the order of vapor compression air conditioners, commonly found in built environments. So in other words, 45 dB is like an air conditioner. So they shouldn't be producing noise. However, there are some arguments where people have said, well, the difference between the noise coming from a wind turbine and from an air conditioner, for example, is that wind turbines, they have this periodicity to it, and that periodicity makes you go loopy. Whereas for air conditioners, it's just a constant noise. So that's one argument. And it's not just the sound pressure level or the loudness. They said a study carried out within the EU project WindEurope in 2006 revealed that 63% of the urban wind turbines on the market had noise levels of less than 40 dBA at wind speeds of 5 meters per second, which indicates that urban wind turbine noise issues can be dealt with in the design. All these studies may lead to the conclusion that, in general, noise emissions do not present particular issues. Researchers in the field of rotor aeroacoustics are nonetheless still active in the optimization of small-scale wind turbine noise. So, they have now a really interesting thing they want to cover. They say vibrations occurring in structures should be minimized since they cause fatigue damage and may lead to further noise emissions. In podcast 48 and 49, I cover this fatigue damage. But what this means is when you have vibrations in the structure, it just then weakens the structure overall, and then it will finally break at a much lower velocity than what you expect. So you need to be aware of the vibration, the fundamental frequency. The fundamental frequency has been the lowest frequency at which a object will vibrate around, it will resonate at. Consequences for the operating wind turbines on buildings are evidently that operating at the natural frequencies of parts of the building, such as floors and walls, should be avoided. Now they have this really cool equation where it links the fundamental frequency to the height of the building, and it's very simple. All it says is the fundamental frequency can be approximated as 46 divided by the height of the building in meters, I'm assuming. So that's a very easy equation to use. So what this means is the larger the building, the lower the fundamental frequency, the smaller the building, the higher the fundamental frequency. And I just like it because the equation is so tight. It's like such an easy equation to boil down to. So that's the end of this podcast. In summary, they say one interesting takeaway is that particular building shapes and the influence on the local aerodynamics have been investigated mainly by means of CFD models, with energy yield improvements of up to 56.1%. So what this means is when in implementing these wind turbines in urban environments, you not only need to consider the wind turbine itself, but the buildings that it's around, because they're going to affect the flow that's hitting the wind turbine. And by clever design, you can exceed things like the Betts limit and get a lot more energy out of your wind turbines. That's cool. So that's in this podcast. Make sure to like, subscribe, and tell all your buddies about it. And check out the Atmosphere Hawk as well. And we'll see you in the next podcast. Peace out, amigos.